All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today we're diving into a pretty fascinating case from 1975. It's called Bringe Collins, and it comes out of the Maryland Court of Appeals.
Oh yeah, Bringe Collins. I remember that one from law school. It's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, it really gets to the heart of how state courts and federal courts sometimes, well, they don't always see eye to eye. And it can get really tricky for us lawyers, and even more so for people who aren't lawyers trying to figure out, what their rights are.
Yeah, and this case is like a textbook example of that.
So what we're going to do today is break down this case, Bringe Collins, and we're going to try to like really make sense of it. Like, what's the big deal here, and what does it mean, for the rest of us, especially if you're just starting out in law?
Especially like for law students, right?
Yeah, definitely. So to give everyone a little background, this whole thing revolves around jury trials. That thing you see in movies where a group of everyday people decides the fate of someone in court.
Right.
So the question here is, do you always get a jury trial, even in like a more everyday kind of dispute, let's say between a landlord and a tenant?
And that's exactly what Bringe Collins is all about. You have a tenant and a landlord battling it out in court, and the tenant saying, "Hey, I should have had a jury decide this."
Okay, so let's set the scene right. This all starts back in 1973 in Maryland. You've got a landlord, Wayne Collins, suing his tenant, John Bringe.
Classic landlord-tenant situation.
Right, but the thing is, Bringe's lease was up and he wasn't moving out. This is what they call holding over.
Exactly. Holding over.
Now, here's a really important detail. Collins wasn't after money from Bringe, like back rent or damages, and neither of them put a specific dollar value on what Bringe's right to stay on the property was actually worth. So it gets a little tricky.
Right, no specific dollar amount. So that becomes kind of a key point, actually.
So things proceed. As usual, the district court rules in favor of the landlord, Collins, Bringe appeals, but the circuit court upholds the decision. Seems pretty straightforward, right?
So far, so good. It's a pretty common situation, actually, with these kinds of eviction cases.
But then, boom, the U.S. Supreme Court drops a major decision, Purnell v. Southall Realty. This case establishes that in eviction cases in Washington, D.C., you absolutely have the right to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment. It's a big
It
deal.
definitely shook things up a bit, yeah.
And this is where things get interesting. Bringe sees this Purnell decision and thinks, aha, this applies to me too. I should have gotten a jury trial in Maryland. So he tries to use the Purnell ruling to his advantage. What the Maryland courts think about that?
Well, they weren't buying it. They basically said, "Nice try, but that was in D.C. Different rules here in Maryland."
So even though it's the Supreme Court, it doesn't automatically mean every state has to follow it, especially when it comes to something like a state-level eviction case.
You got it. And that's where the real meat of Bringe Collins comes in. What are the core legal questions that the Maryland Court of Appeals had to grapple with?
Okay, so lay it on us. What were those big constitutional questions?
Well, there are two major ones. The first one, and this is a really big one for law nerds like me, is whether the Seventh Amendment's right to a jury trial, the one for civil cases, should automatically apply to state courts as well.
Okay, so that's like, does what the federal courts say automatically bind the state courts? That seems like a huge deal.
It is a huge deal. It gets into this whole thing called the Incorporation Doctrine, which is basically like which parts of the Bill of Rights apply to the states because of the 14th Amendment.
Oh, yeah, the 14th Amendment. That one's always coming up.
Right. And then the second big question is much more specific to Bringe and his situation. Did Maryland law itself, completely separate from the Seventh Amendment, actually guarantee Bringe a jury trial in his eviction case? Like, did Maryland have its own rule about this?
Ah, okay, so two separate issues then. The big federal question about the Seventh Amendment, and then the more specific question of what Maryland's own laws said about jury trials in this situation. So let's break it down. What about that first big question about the Seventh Amendment? It sounds like Bringe was basically saying, hey, the Supreme Court said jury trials are a must in DC eviction cases, so that should apply to my case here in Maryland too, right?
Yeah, he was trying to ride the wave of the Purnell decision, hoping that the Supreme Court's ruling would like magically extend to his case in Maryland. The idea is that the Seventh Amendment should be incorporated against the states through the 14th Amendment.
Right, make those protections apply equally everywhere. But the Maryland Court of Appeals kind of shut that down, huh?
Oh, yeah, they shut it down hard. They basically said, "Look, the Supreme Court has said over and over again that the Seventh Amendment hasn't been incorporated against the states." And what that means is that the Seventh Amendment only applies directly to cases in federal courts.
So states can do their own thing when it comes to jury trials.
To a certain extent, yeah. They have their own rules about when a jury trial is required, and those rules come from their own state constitutions and state laws.
Huh. So it's different from, say, the First Amendment and free speech, which applies to the states.
Right, exactly. It's a good distinction to make.
So in Bringe, the court was basically saying, look, we're not bound by what happened in D.C. with Purnell. The Seventh Amendment doesn't apply to us directly.
That's exactly it. It's a good example of why you always have to check the state constitution and laws first, especially when you're talking about state court procedures.
Okay, so big takeaway there. State law reigns supreme in state court.
Got it. So let's move to Maryland then. What did their laws actually say about jury trials, and how did that apply to Bringe?
All right, so you got to look at the Maryland Constitution, specifically Article XV, Section 6. It lays out the rules for jury trials, and it says that the right to a jury trial in civil cases only kicks in if the amount of money being fought over is more than $500.
Oh, there's a dollar amount attached to it. Yeah, there's a threshold. And remember, in Bringe's case, the landlord wasn't asking for money.
And Bringe didn't say, hey, my right to stay here is worth more than $500 or anything like that.
Nope, he didn't. So right from the start, he didn't meet that financial requirement from the state constitution.
Okay, so that's strike one. But I thought you said there was another issue too, right? Something about Maryland's court rules.
Yeah, there's this thing called Maryland District Rule 343. And it basically says, if you want a jury trial, you got to specifically ask for it. And you got to do it within a certain time frame.
Oh, so you can't just assume you're getting a jury.
Nope, you got to be proactive. And guess what? Bringe didn't request a jury trial at the beginning in the district court.
Oh, so even if the right to stay in the property was worth more than $500, the fact that he didn't ask for a jury would have sunk his case anyway?
Yep, pretty much. The Maryland Court of Appeals really hammered home the point that you got to follow the rules. They even said that even big, important constitutional rights, like the right to a jury trial, can be waived if you don't follow the proper procedures.
Wow, so it's like, knowing your rights is important, but knowing how to use them is just as important.
Totally. And, you know, later on, Bringe tried to get around all of this. He tried to challenge the eviction judgment by asking for something called declaratory relief.
Declaratory relief? What's that?
It's basically him going to the court and saying, hey, that eviction wasn't valid because I didn't get a jury trial.
Ah, so he's trying to undo everything after the fact. Did it work?
Nope. The court wasn't having it. They saw it as what we call a collateral attack on the judgment. Like, you can't just ignore the rules at the beginning and then try to come back later and fix things through some other legal maneuver. You had your chance. You didn't take it. That's it.
Okay, so we've got the Seventh Amendment argument. That's a no-go. We've got Maryland's own rules about jury trials. That's a no-go. But didn't Bringe also argue that Maryland's eviction law itself was unconstitutional?
Yeah, he did. He went after a specific section of the law, Section 8402B. He basically said that it was unconstitutional because it didn't specifically say that you have a right to a jury trial in eviction cases.
So his argument is because the law doesn't explicitly say you get a jury, that means you don't get a jury, and that's unconstitutional.
You got it. But the Maryland Court of Appeals pushed back on that in a couple of really interesting ways.
Oh, how so?
Well, first, they pointed out that the law itself doesn't actually say anything about jury trials one way or the other. It's completely silent on the issue.
So it doesn't say you do get a jury, but it also doesn't say you don't.
Right, exactly. It's neutral.
Yeah.
And the court said that because of this silence, the general rules about jury trials in Maryland still apply. Mm-hmm. You know, that $500 limit we talked about and that rule about having to actually request a jury trial.
Okay, so the law doesn't mention juries, but that doesn't automatically make it unconstitutional. It just means the general rules still apply.
That's right. And the second thing the court brought up is this really interesting legal concept called statutory severability.
Statutory severability? That sounds complicated.
It's not as bad as it sounds. Basically, the court was saying that even if part of the eviction law was found to be unconstitutional because of this whole jury trial thing, the court could just get rid of that specific problematic part and leave the rest of the law intact. They wouldn't have to throw the whole law out.
Oh, interesting. So it's like they're surgeons. They can just remove the bad part and leave the rest.
Yeah. It's a way for courts to fix specific problems with a law without having to get rid of the entire thing.
Makes sense. So Brenny's challenge to the eviction law itself, that didn't work either.
Nope. No dice.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground here. So for our listeners, especially those of you who are in law school right now, what are the really key things to learn from Bringe v. Collins? What should they be taking notes on?
Absolutely. There are a few big lessons here. So first up, you got to understand this thing called the incorporation doctrine. Like, seriously, it's huge.
Right. That's the whole, does this part of the Bill of Rights apply to the states?
Specifically. And Breen shows us clearly that the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial in civil cases, that one hasn't been incorporated. So when you're dealing with state law issues, always start with the state constitution and the state's laws. That's where you'll find the answers you need.
Don't just assume that everything that's in the U.S. Constitution applies automatically at the state level.
Don't assume anything. Always check the state's own rules first. Okay, the second big lesson from Bringe is the importance of what we call procedural compliance. And that's a fancy way of saying follow the rules.
Yeah, those deadlines and procedures are there for a reason.
Right. Like in Bringe, the guy missed his chance to ask for a jury trial, and that was it. He lost that right. So pay attention to the deadlines. File the right forms, and make sure you're doing everything by the book. It can make all the difference.
It's all about the details, especially in law. All right, what's our third big lesson?
The third one is this cool concept called statutory severability. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, the surgical removal of the bad parts of a law.
Exactly. So understand that courts can sometimes strike down just the parts of a law that are unconstitutional without getting rid of the whole thing. It's a way for them to keep laws working as much as possible.
And finally, for anyone interested in landlord-tenant law, Bringe really drives home the point that eviction cases are meant to be quick and efficient. Jury trials aren't automatic, and there are very specific hoops you have to jump through to get one.
Yeah, like that $500 threshold and the requirement to actually request a jury. It's all about keeping things moving.
It's a reminder that the legal system, especially at the state level, can be very specific, and it's up to us lawyers to navigate those specifics for our clients.
And that's a good segue into some of the specific details from Bringe that are worth mentioning again, like the court's discussion of Turnell v. Southall Realty. That's super important for understanding why Bringe's Seventh Amendment argument failed.
Right. Comparing those two cases really highlights the difference between federal and state law. What else?
Well, the court's reference to the Maryland Constitution, Article XV, Section 6, you know, that one with the $500 threshold, that's a cornerstone of their reasoning. And then there's the whole discussion about Maryland District Rule 343 and how not following that rule can basically mean you waive your right to a jury.
Yeah, that's a hard lesson to learn, but it's important.
Oh, absolutely. And then there's this really powerful statement from the court where they say that even constitutional rights can be waived if you don't follow reasonable procedural rules.
Oof, that's got a sting.
Yeah, it underscores how important those procedural rules are. And finally, the courts focus on the fact that the eviction law, Section 8402B, doesn't actually say anything about jury trials. That's crucial. It shows how they used that silence to apply the general rules about juries and to avoid striking down the whole law.
It's like a masterclass in legal reasoning.
It really is.
Okay, so to wrap up our deep dive into Bringe Collins, we've seen that the Seventh Amendment doesn't just automatically apply in state court, that following procedural rules is absolutely critical, and that even if part of a law is unconstitutional, courts will try their best to keep the rest of it working.
Exactly. It's all about understanding how the different pieces of the legal puzzle fit together.
And now for the big question for all you law students out there. How does all of this whole incorporation doctrine thing and the nitty-gritty details of state procedural rules, how does that change how you're going to think about legal strategy and how you're going to advise your clients?
Yeah, especially in areas like landlord-tenant law, where state law is so, so important.
It's a lot to think about, but it's what makes law so fascinating, right?
Right.
And here's one more thing to ponder. What are the ethical considerations here? Like, what happens when someone loses a major constitutional right simply because they didn't dot an I or cross a T procedurally?
Oh, man, that's a tough one.
It's something to keep in mind as you move forward in your legal careers. All right, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Bringe v. Collins. We'll see you next time.
See you then.